Seth, welcome on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Jake. Really excited to chat today.
Yeah, my pleasure. So first of all, shout out to Andrew Bailey for putting us in touch. Really appreciate his time and excellent episode that he did with me on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, or a couple of months ago now, actually. And I confess, I also still haven't finished Resistance Money. I've got it on my trip at the moment. I'm like, I've got to finish this book this week. But there is a section in there which for me really hit home what we're talking about when it comes to digital peer-to-peer cash. Mm-hmm. And it was talking about how cash currently functions, i.e. you have backwards anonymity and forwards, i.e. when you receive a $10 note or euro or, you know, whatever currency you might be working in, you don't know where it's come from. And when you give it to someone else, you don't know where it's going. When we're working in the digital realm, that's not as easy. Mm-hmm. And Seth, I would love to get your take on, you know, what is privacy to you? And how do we start to think about privacy in the digital world?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on something really valuable there, which is that the concept of privacy is so different now than what it used to be before the internet, and really before like the internet became integral to every part of our lives, including the financial parts of our lives. Mm. Because if you go back like 50 years, the concept of privacy is just not something people are thinking about actively, because it's a natural state of things. You're generally going to have privacy unless you're choosing to go onto a radio show, unless you're choosing to call someone over the phone. But you're generally going to have privacy in everything you do, because most of what you do is not happening in a digital, always online, always surveilled, always preserved system. So we're having to kind of rethink how this stuff actually works and actually think consciously about privacy as an individual for the first time, I think, really, in the existence of humanity, which sounds a little bigger in scope than maybe it needs to. But I think that's a lot of the reasons why a lot of the problems exist today that they do, because we just haven't really thought about it, and we just let things become how they are without having conscious decisions and in place about what privacy looks like. So really, privacy to me is, it's very simple. It's just having the choice what data about you exists out there in the ether and what data doesn't exist. It's really just the means to an end. And I think, especially in the privacy space, it can often get overblown and become this thing of where, like, I want privacy for privacy's sake. Mm. But that's not actually valuable in and of itself. And a lot of people who dive too deeply into the privacy rabbit hole, like I've done, many people I know have done, it actually ends up becoming something that's harmful to human flourishing and harmful to human freedom, because you limit yourself so much because you're so paranoid and so worried about what could be out there. So it's always this balance. It's really about empowering human freedom, empowering human flourishing in a world where privacy is not the default state anymore. And quite the opposite, surveillance is the default state for most people, unfortunately. So clawing back some of that is really what privacy is today.
Cool. Oh my gosh, what an awesome conversation we're going to have today. And so as you talk through that, it strikes me that it's kind of like, you know, if you're too libertarian, you are no longer part of any tribe whatsoever. And there exists extreme risk when you go completely solo. And perhaps it's similar when it comes to the privacy rabbit hole. It's like, if you're just too private, then you're going to really struggle to survive. What I'd love to understand, Seth, is like, how did you even become interested in this as a subject? And what happened to you that you were like, whoa, this is actually a pretty big deal that I want to spend a lot of time thinking about?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because you started off asking about this concept of physical cash, digital cash, peer-to-peer cash. That's really actually how I got into privacy. I didn't care at all about personal privacy. My background is all in IT and cybersecurity, which cybersecurity is kind of the opposite of of digital privacy, because my job as a cybersecurity engineer was essentially surveilling other people. Now, obviously, wow, in a business really? Setting on business computers, it's different than your personal data, your personal conversations. But that's really my background. And
cool.
What changed that for me was actually that when I got into cryptocurrency, I got into Bitcoin, like many people, I just got into it for the network go up. I just wanted to make more money. It seemed like a good kind of penny stock sort of thing as I was starting out my career. And what actually made it click was I got into Monero, which is a privacy centric cryptocurrency, because I wanted to be able to mine it with GPUs at home. It's just like a really cool tech hobby thing. I'm a tech enthusiast at heart. And once I got embedded into that community, it became very clear to me that there's something else here. Like, this isn't just about making money. There's actually some human good that can come from this stuff. And getting deeper and deeper into the Monero community, it being a privacy-centric, privacy-by-default cryptocurrency, necessarily a lot of the community are very privacy-conscious. And just in conversations with people, I just finally started to understand, like, financial privacy matters. But that's only a small piece of the puzzle. Like, a broader personal privacy is necessary for human freedom, and financial privacy is a critical aspect of that. I think without financial privacy, the rest of our human rights will be quickly eroded, because if we're not able to speak freely with what we want to buy, who we want to fund, everything else falls apart quickly. But that's only a piece of that puzzle. And so that actually what started me down that rabbit hole of personal privacy was that community kind of being like, hey, like, there's more to it than this. And then I did what I think is becoming a little bit more normal route. I kind of fell down the Snowden rabbit hole. I hadn't kept up with what he had unveiled in 2011. I hadn't kept up with a lot of what had happened over the few years after that. But read what was his latest book at the time. This was 2019, I think. Read a few books by Glenn Greenwald, who had been instrumental in that process as well. And just started to understand the broader issues at stake. And at the same time, understanding that the system I was working in the cybersecurity world was often complicit, or at least being very much used by governments to break down the privacy, to break down the choices that we had. So it was a very quick rabbit hole dive for me that started with just wanting to make money and then finally realizing, like, hey, there's actually so much more to this technology than just gaining more fiat at the end of the day, gaining more dollars. There's something that can really be a critical good for human flourishing here.
Yeah, I love the phrase, came for the gains, stayed for the revolution.
And yeah, it's a good one.
It's so true. And I'm very similar in that sense of like hunting for places to earn returns as an investor, and then suddenly realizing that Bitcoin's probably the best investment you've ever made. To me, cybersecurity is something I know very little about. And from the outside, kind of looking in, for some reason, my instinct that it's like a defensive thing. Like cybersecurity, you know, the word security is like you've got to stay safe with the cyber world. But perhaps from what you've just touched on, it's actually more offensive in that the people that actually know what they're doing are able to monitor or surveil the activity of others without them even really realizing. So what is a cybersecurity engineer? And yeah, what were some of the kind of key lessons that came out of that experience for you?
Yeah. So there's two main sides to cybersecurity. There's what would be called red team and blue team. So blue team would be the people who are more defensive, who are more putting things in place so that we can see when there's a cybersecurity breach, see if an employee is trying to steal intellectual property, that sort of thing. But then there's also red team, which is the offensive side of things, where they're trying to find vulnerabilities. They're actively investigating people who are potentially doing bad things on the company's network. They're much more offensive and much more like targeted surveillance, or actually like attacking the company, but from within to try and find potential issues. Mostly I worked on the blue team side. So our focus was broad surveillance. Essentially, we wanted to know everything about what our employees were doing on the network, everything about what they were doing with files in their computer, everything about whose computer was talking to what, about what was within our server network, about what was within our like company-wide network. Really, like you said, it's trying to collect every bit of data possible, but in a way that's actually actionable and parsable. Like, you don't just want data for data's sake, but you want things you can actually make sense of and actually connect the dots between. So I think, like, for me, the main things that I learned was, I think I will just say, like, especially if anyone is a cybersecurity engineer or anything listening, like, there's a real good use case for cybersecurity, obviously, and for surveillance within a company. Like, there's reasons to do that that are very necessary and understandable. So I'm certainly not like denigrating the whole profession or anything like that. But what I did learn very quickly was the tools available are immensely powerful. And a lot of the privacy tooling out there that people think protects them actually only protects a very small aspect of what they're doing. One very small example of that is like one of the projects that I was able to work on when I was in the industry was Okay, so HTTPS is the normal SSL, this encryption of when you're going to google.com, your connection is being encrypted. That's become normal, so that limits what we're able to see as a cybersecurity team. But what people generally don't realize is that there's an immense amount of metadata that's still being sent between you and google.com when you're making that connection. And there's ways that us as a company can man in the middle that connection and see everything that's happening, even if you don't know it in the first place. There's tooling out there that can figure out the vast majority of what you're doing, even if you are using encryption all the time, even if you are using a better browser, better tools. And that just helped, I think, to give me some perspective on how much of an arms race privacy is, that it's not, there's not just this kind of static field of like, you are private or you're not, or this tool is perfect forever or it's not, but rather it's this constant arms race where we were constantly escalating the tooling that we were using. Bad actors were constantly escalating the tooling they were using. And it's something that always continues. The other lesson that I learned was, like I briefly touched on before, unfortunately, a lot of cybersecurity tooling and a lot of companies that are major cybersecurity companies out there are complicit and happy to aid governments, even authoritarian governments, in persecuting individuals who should not be persecuted. I say this, I've publicized this story, I think, once before, but I actually worked for Cisco, who are one of the largest IT companies in the world, one of the largest cybersecurity companies in the world. And the reason I left and actually got into the cryptocurrency space full time was that I was fed up after I realized by reading through some EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation documents, that Cisco had been essentially building surveillance tech for the Chinese government to persecute the Uyghur people, and had been making massive amounts of money doing so, had been caught doing so, had not stopped, and continued to say that they weren't doing it, but there was immense evidence to support that they were doing it. That court case has progressed. It's still not over, but the EFF has been winning the court case so far, proving that this had been ongoing. Now, I wasn't involved in that. No one that I knew within Cisco was involved with that project directly. But obviously, that's just something where like the tooling that I am using day-to-day is the same tooling that's being built out to persecute a religious people like the Uyghurs. And the company that I'm giving my time to is leveraging these tools to do this. And obviously, that was way too far, not something that I wanted to support, and was, again, maybe like the final wake-up call for me of like, this is serious, because it's not just like me and my privileged Western view of, yeah, I'm surveilled, but like I don't feel the impacts every day. But like there's people who are actively dying or living in concentration camps because of this technology and because of the tooling available. So it made it much more real to me that I needed to do more than just protect myself, to just care about my own personal privacy and my own personal security, but I needed to find ways to help others achieve the same thing.
Awesome. And Seth, what I love learning is why people do things. So the decision-making process that we go through, and we are the sum of all of those right now, in this present moment, you know, everything we've done to date takes us to right now. And so it's a very revealing part of who you are in some ways to just talk us through that. So basically, you're faced, I suppose, with a question on your ethics and your morals. If you could kind of spend a little more time there, like what was it about that pissed you off? And then just take us in the direction you went after. That also teaches me so much.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing for me was coming to grips with the fact that, like, especially when you're in the corporate world, you are dedicating the majority of your life to this company. Like my plan was to stay with Cisco until I retired. So we're talking 45 years of 40 to 60 hours a week at the very minimum, lots of travel. Like if I'm going to give the vast majority of my output, essentially, like if you think about it, you're working a full-time job, yeah, most of your production is going towards this company. Obviously there's outside stuff, but most of your production is going towards this company. Like I really think this paradigm that is at least very American, I don't want to speak for the whole world, but at least very American of like, it doesn't matter what my company is or does. It just matters that I provide for my family and I work well. And I don't think like that's not, obviously not a terrible thing. That's not a terrible view, but it's kind of become the norm, or at least for like my generation and maybe the generation before in the US, of like, it doesn't really matter what's going on. I'm just going to do my job and keep my head down, provide for my family and move on with my life. Look towards retirement. Don't worry about what happens now. And I was already very unsettled with that idea even before I learned about any of what had been going on at Cisco, like already trying to figure out like, do I really want to do this for 45 years for a company who could care less about me or could care less about like the good of other engineers who I know who are working their asses off and doing a fantastic job, but not being recognized because they're just a cog in the machine. So there was already that like unsettled feeling, but that incident learning from the EFF that there was this oppression going on and that Cisco was not only being used, like it's one thing if Cisco was just like selling off the shelf products to the Chinese government, still bad, I think still unethical, but to learn that they were explicitly customizing, building unique software, building out the exact hardware that these, that the Chinese government would need for this specific purpose was frightening, because it told me that at the very top of this company, there are zero moral scruples. Like all they care about is the bottom line, and they're willing to literally sell human lives to achieve profit. And so that like, I couldn't stomach giving my life's productivity essentially to a company where very clearly they did not care about human good or human flourishing and generally just cared about profits. So I think like that was really the driver for me. It's like, I have to get out of here. I have to do something else. What that looked like afterwards initially was I actually went and worked for a fantastic nonprofit that focused on essentially providing human aid. They had very specific, very unique cybersecurity engineering requirements because they had to essentially be able to work no matter what government censorship looked like. So there's some really cool engineering tasks I was able to do there and a really cool team that I got to work with. But at the same time, I had started my own podcast. I had started my own blog. I had built out kind of a platform around personal privacy, about cryptocurrency, Bitcoin and Monero specifically. And so there was still that passion of like, I don't love the engineering task. I love the good of this company that I had switched to, but I didn't love the engineering task and really wanted to do something where, again, I wanted all of my productivity to go towards this passion of mine, to go towards what I saw as like a really necessary thing for humanity to flourish, instead of just part of my time and my extra hours. So that's when I made the jump into Bitcoin, starting with Foundation, who are a hardware wallet company for Bitcoin. Fantastic company. Can't speak highly enough for them. And then jumping over to Cake Wallet in September of last year as VP.
Cool. And in terms of the kind of career steps, we'll get to that later in the conversation, I think, because I'm keen to learn, particularly about Cake and what you're doing there. It's very obvious why. Like, okay, Cisco, you know, fuck you guys. Not cool. I'm out. And that's like a stake in the ground moment. You've already touched on the idea of freedom and financial freedom as being critical to, or like a cornerstone of like all human rights. This is a massive conversation and absolutely not something that would just be 60 minutes of you and I, you know, chatting about it. But the word freedom means different things to different people. But maybe you can kind of bring this to life in a sense. So you've already talked through the use case of a government that is oppressing a certain ethnicity for whatever purpose it may be, and they're using digital technology to do that, versus what we touched on before, which is 50 years ago, and privacy is kind of the default. So where have we come from, and where are we going to in this like everyday tasks? You know, I want to buy a book. Well, I'm on Amazon. I want to search something. I've just gone onto Google. Oh, I want to send my friend a photo. Okay, well, I've just tagged them on Instagram. You know, going through these like huge digital monopolies on the back end that are monetizing your attention with adverts and whatever else they're up to as business models, you're on their digital real estate. But you're not just like on it for, you know, a couple of percent of the day. Like some people spend more time online than they do in physical reality now. It's absolutely wild how quickly it's shifted in this other direction. I read the other day that Instagram has 1.5 billion daily active users. Like it's mind-blowingly big, right? Seth, what does it mean, right? If we're doing our groceries online, we're doing our banking online, we're doing our communication online, we're doing absolutely everything online. I'd love you to really just paint a picture as to like what the problem is, if that makes sense.
For sure. I mean, I think like an important thing to remember is that there actually is a lot of, there are a lot of positives with the online world that we live in. The ability for me to go on Amazon and buy something while I'm sitting on the couch watching a movie and have it delivered 2 days later. Like these are fantastic things that actually do improve our lives. So like, I don't want to say that like all of this online world is a negative. A lot of it really is positive and beneficial. But like I mentioned earlier, I think the biggest issue is that we came from this world of privacy being the default, and we shifted so rapidly into our lives being almost entirely online that I don't think many people gave it a conscious thought about like what this actually looks like. Because when you're faced with a new paradigm, it's just very difficult to think through what are all the ramifications, like what are the unknown unknowns of what this could actually mean for us individually as a society. And a lot of that stuff just wasn't thought through. Like I don't think there's this huge malicious kind of like big brother out there who's coordinating everything perfectly to surveil and control. There certainly are some bigger bad actors, but the vast majority of this is just companies that saw like, I think we can make money by selling ads. Maybe if we personalize them more, we can make even more money because we can have a better click-through ratio for our ad providers. And a lot of it just comes from like, this is a clear financial, a clear monetization model for the internet. And it wasn't, I don't think, thought through as this way of like, oh, we also will know everything about people so that we can control what they do in the future, or so that we can oppress them in the future. But it started again, just as like everyone was caught up in this paradigm and just started figuring out like, how do I best build this out for me, or best build this out for my business? And so it quickly has some massive second and third order effects that cause problems. And I think like when you're thinking about your personal privacy in this, like, it's tricky because again, you don't want to go too far. Like I, like many other people in the privacy space, have, you start this thought process of like how bad things are. You start this thought process of how broken the system is and like how problematic Amazon is and all these, and it can quickly spiral to where you isolate yourself. You're not online in any sense. So you're also harming what you're actually able to do because you're not able to use services that are legitimately beneficial. You're keeping yourself away from other people. You're cutting people off because they're not using the right privacy preserving messenger or something. And it actually is really harmful for you. I would argue much more harmful than being surveilled, at least for much of the world. Obviously there are places where being surveilled could mean life or death, but in much of the Western world, especially, that's not true yet. But it is definitely this balance of figuring out like, okay, so this system is broken. We went from default privacy to default surveillance. Much of that exists because my data is worth a lot. Like the data about who I am and what I do, what I care about, what I buy, what I watch, that data is immensely valuable to advertisers and to businesses trying to sell things. How do I start to escape that broken model, and how do I start to change that model itself? And like when we talk about escaping that broken model, I don't know how far you want to get into the personal privacy rabbit hole, but there's some simple low-hanging fruit that you can do. Use a better browser that has default ad blocking, something like Brave Browser, where it's going to prevent the most basic of monitoring and surveillance that's out there. It could be use something like a better chat app like Signal, so that your direct private communications are not being surveilled by a third party like Facebook or Twitter. That could be something more extreme, like using a VPN so that your internet service provider can't see immense detail about what you do. That kind of calls back to what I mentioned about cybersecurity before, like the amount of insight that your internet service provider has into what you do, even when you're using HTTPS for all your connections, is immense. If they really want to know everything about you, they will. And many ISPs have been caught or just openly collecting data about all of their users so that they can sell more personalized ads, and they have a unique window into what you do versus any specific site, because they have a window into everything you do while you're at home or while you're on the go. So it can go down this broad path, and I would again urge caution, go one step at a time, but that kind of taking back your personal privacy is absolutely vital, and I would recommend people dig into that more. But then there's also the flip side of how do we change this broken model? Rather than just escaping it, how do we actually start to improve this broken system? Like I said, I think much of the surveillance online is not by malicious government seeking to control you. Some of it certainly is, but much of it is just companies who have a business model that they've built out that's easy for them, where it's just collect data, sell data. Like that it's a simple model that works very well today for companies, and it allows them to not have to compete on having the best product, because they can compete on monopolies, they can compete on data sales, pushing up their bottom line. And so changing that model to me looks like using products and companies that don't operate on that model. I think a great example is, like we touched on Google earlier. Google is the default search, and on Apple, it's the default go-to for many people today. But they live by surveilling you, by selling your data, and by selling you personalized ads. If you want to break that monopoly, you can go use someone like Kagi, just K-A-G-I, and it's $5 a month. They don't have any ads in their system. They don't operate on data collection. They're privacy-centric at the core of what they do. And not only does that improve your own personal privacy, but when we fund companies who actually care about us as individuals, who actually care about giving us the choice of what data we're revealing to the world, we start to shift that paradigm away. If companies like that get enough funding, it starts to become clear to Google, Apple, et cetera, okay, this ad monopoly, this ad business is not going to last us forever. We're going to have to start shifting things. And I think you're starting to see some of that. Like if you look at Apple's marketing, if you look at a lot of the feature set that Apple has built out recently, it's built around personal privacy. It's built around end-to-end encryption, because they understand that this is actually something people want by and large. And this is actually something that's coming one way or another. And so they're trying to get ahead of it. Whereas Google and others, I think, are often lagging a little bit more behind. But I think it's very important that not only do we reclaim our own personal privacy so we have choice, but we also support companies who are actually breaking out of this model, who are actually doing things the right way, use products, buy them, so that we can start to shift what that paradigm looks like as well.
Awesome, Seth. Thank you for taking me through all that. And it's interesting. It's basically just a tiered set of steps. It's like how far down the rabbit hole do you want to go? And it's reminding me of when I went to, there's an event in Australia that I would go to called the Bitcoin Bush Bash, and it's held in different locations around Australia. And shout out to the guys that run that. And I went to my first ever one. I don't know if you've ever come across Katan before, but he runs a business called
Ministry of Legend.
Yeah, you know,
absolute
Katan.
Legend. Good friend.
Okay, awesome. Shout out to Katan. And he has this awesome presentation called, you know, My Digital Fortress. And he's basically running you through all these different tools that he's got to help him get the fuck away from Google. Predominantly, it's Google. Just they have built themselves this extraordinary empire of very, very usable products that all work with each other so seamlessly that you don't even realize that you're using Google in some ways. So I stuck my hand up. I was like, well, if I really wanted to do this, like, how long would it take me? Like a couple of days? And the whole room like starts laughing. It's like, it's no, mate. This is a ongoing process that's going to take a lot of time and effort to actually put into place. And I'm so with you. I love that. So Kagi, I've written that down. Pay for products that you want. It makes sense. Like actually just get on and pay. And of course, if you're interested in this subject, privacy, if the product's free, you're the product. And we always kind of forget this, you know what I mean? So it's just so convenient, you know, just give them an email address and a password and off you go. But at what cost? And so that's a word I'd love to dig into more. Like what are the costs then? So let's say you aren't as clued up with this conversation as you might be with your digital behavior. What is it costing you?
I think it really depends. So it's hard to say exactly what it's costing each individual listener right now, because it very much depends on where you are. And a lot of times the costs for privacy, and I think one of the reasons why people don't realize the importance of taking personal privacy seriously sooner, is that a lot of the costs and a lot of the benefits of privacy are not felt now. A lot of them are very much delayed gratification and delayed impact, which is very much countercultural to where we are today, where people need to feel it right now. They need to know this is actually making a difference. This is actually changing something. And a lot of the things that you'll do to improve your personal privacy, you're just not going to feel right now, especially like those of us in the Western world, those of us in America. There's very little day-to-day impact from the surveillance economy that exists today. Like you're not going to feel in a malicious or a harmful way that Google is building a profile about you that could tell you things about yourself you might not even know, that could tell you things about your spouse that you definitely don't know. That's not something that you feel because it's not immediately apparent, and there's no one leveraging that to actively harm you normally. Now, if you look at a lot of the world, that's quite different. And those things, that data collection, that surveillance, can actually be something that is directly impactful and harmful to your everyday life. I think if you talk to people who were like part of the Soviet bloc, you'll realize they have a very different perspective on privacy and surveillance. They have a much more core culture of privacy and of autonomy because they've seen what the harmful effects of a surveillance state can actually do. Whereas like those of us in America haven't felt that need as much. So I think like when we talk about the felt costs, it's very hard to describe. What the actual costs are is right now we're going to be surveilled. All of the data about us is going to be collated and collected. And things can quickly shift. We've seen shifts from democratic to authoritarian regimes over the course of 10, 15 years, even less, in many countries around the world over the last 100 years. Like this is a process that can happen very, very quickly. And that data that's being collected now will be in the hands of whoever that government is. These corporations that are collecting that data, they're generally beholden to governments, and they're going to need to give up any data that governments request. So even if you're living in a very free, very low impact to a lack of privacy country like the US today, that can change very, very quickly. And I think that's one of the things that people have to think about. If you're not feeling the need for privacy today, you need to think about what happens if that person that I hate in politics takes over and has access to all of this data about me. Or what happens if my country goes south really quickly, like has happened dozens of times in history, and an authoritarian regime, a dictator, a military state takes control and they have all this data about me. You might be fine right now, but that can be very problematic in the future. So I think that's normally the way that I approach it here in the West, where there's not as much of a felt need, but rather you need to think about the most hated person you've ever had in politics, the group where you're like, if this group had control, like my life would change drastically. You need to think about what happens when they get access to those tools and when they get access to that data, and start to game plan, like making sure that you and your family are better protected against that, but taking it one step at a time.
Awesome. And it sounds very, very, very good advice. It's making me think about a post I saw recently where if you think you've deleted something on a social media platform, you basically removed it from sight for yourself and the user base, but the actual company still has that data sitting somewhere. And so essentially everything you do online leaves a breadcrumb of some form somewhere. And therefore, being at least as an initial phase aware of that fact is very important, because you could get, you know, held accountable essentially for your behavior in the past. Now, words or ideas, so thoughts are not words, words are not actions. So, you know, draw the line ethically as to like when someone's responsible for something. And there have been headlines recently back in my home country of the UK of people being arrested for social media posts.
Absurd. Like, yeah.
Unbelievable, right? Like, at what point has a government become so powerful? Is that, do you know what I mean? It's nuts what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. Should that person have posted, to take away from the specific story, which I don't necessarily have to mind right now, the point is that when you interact online, you leave this information behind you, regardless if you think you've deleted or not.
Yeah, I think there's one other cost that I want to mention too before I move on quickly that actually comes into play, especially with that idea of like social media being something that can actually land you in jail, is that a lack of privacy, even if you don't specifically feel the issues around what that data getting out in the world, what that chat being surveilled actually means for you right now, what does actually happen and what has been proven over many psychological studies, very well reviewed, very well understood, is that self-censorship becomes just a core part of your life. Like you learn to self-censor when you're concerned with what someone will do with the data that you have, with what someone will do with that conversation you had in a private chat, on what someone will do with that meme that you posted to your group chat. When those things can come back to haunt you, it quickly shifts the way that you think and the way that you speak. And it changes freedom of expression. It changes creativity. It really reduces the amount that we can be human when you think that you're being surveilled. And that's a cost that I think people can feel today that maybe they don't think about as much because it becomes just kind of a subconscious thing. but that's definitely one that I think is impactful. And the harsher governments get, the more people will start to self-censor and start to shift the way that they talk because they don't feel free, because they don't feel free to speak. And that has, again, second and third order effects that are like crucial to culture, to society.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. That rapidly changes those things. So I think that's a critical one to remember. And that was honestly one of the things that first hit home with me when I started taking my privacy journey, was like this idea of self-censorship was real. And I realized it was something I was already doing because I was using these platforms and thinking twice before I posted something on Facebook, or I wasn't going to use Facebook Messenger the same way I was going to talk to somebody in real life, because I was concerned like this stuff could come back to haunt me, even though I'm not doing anything evil or malicious or hateful or anything like that. It's still not a good way to live. So yeah, I mean, when we transition into like what practical steps you can take, we touched on them a bit, and I'll share a blog post that I wrote around this for you to throw in the show notes as well. Sure. Because this is something that, like, over the first few years of me going through this privacy journey, I wish that more people had said, this is the way I personally approached it, and this is why, so that I could more actively think about what's most important to me when it comes to privacy. Something that is just not talked about nearly as much as it should within the privacy space is this idea of threat modeling. So it's just, what do you have to protect? Who are you trying to protect it from? Awesome. And how far are you willing to go to protect it? Mm. And it's a very simple concept. It can take a lot of time if you're very, very detail oriented. It could take not a lot of time if you just sit down and think through it quickly. But starting your privacy journey by thinking about, like, what is your actual goal, is vital to making sure that not only do you make the most practical and useful steps for yourself earlier, but you also don't go too far. Like, I've mentioned it a couple of times already, but myself and almost everyone I talk to who has started to take this privacy journey have gone too far at some point and made it much more difficult for ourselves, gotten burnt out. And a lot of that comes when you don't think about, like, who actually am I? Who actually wants my data? How far can I practically go without really harming my actual life, like the flourishing that I want to experience? If you don't think about that, you generally will go with this, like, paranoid threat model of, like, the NSA is specifically targeting me kind of threat model. One that maybe is realistic for you, the listener, is not realistic for the vast majority of people, and can cause a lot of problems. So starting out by threat modeling, thinking through those three things, making sure that you understand where you want to go, and then just taking actionable steps. I mean, one that we didn't touch on yet, but one that I think is really vital, is finding a community who can really help you out on that journey. That could be a community around a podcast like yours. That could be people that you already know in real life, maybe who care about personal privacy. That could be a community on Twitter. It doesn't have to be a community in a perfectly privacy-preserving tool either. It can be something that's social and that involves getting together and maybe involves not the most perfect privacy, but that community is going to be the vital piece that makes sure that you actually are able to achieve this. Because, like it or not, we're social beings. Like, humans are not meant to do things like this alone. We're not meant to cut all ties, to not have relationships. We need other people around us, and having other people who can actually support you and also help to maybe limit how aggressively you jump into this, give you some caution when you're maybe going a little too far, is really, really important. Beyond that, we touched on a few of the other things. Jumping into a good browser is one of those changes where, like, it can actually really benefit your life. It's not painful. Like, jumping from something like Chrome to Brave browser will have immense privacy impacts, but also just getting rid of a lot of the crud on the internet makes things easier. It makes life more enjoyable when you're browsing. So I think that's a great place to start for most people. From a privacy and security perspective, using a password manager, something like ProtonPass or Bitwarden, so that you're not reusing the same password across all your accounts, is really important. And I think people normally think about this just from a security perspective, but when you think about, if someone gets access to your accounts, you do lose your security, but you also lose all your privacy. If you lose access to your Gmail because you've reused the same password on 27 different sites, and one of those sites loses their password database, you lose all the privacy of everything that had happened there. Not only was it revealed to Google because you're using Gmail, but now it's revealed to that hacker and anyone he chooses to show that to or sell that to. So that's another important.
It's normally like the password. Random, like, you know, parking meter company that you go and stick the email address and password to use for everything. It's like, well, now you're given the ticket to go and have a look at your Gmail. Yeah, that's a disaster.
Yep, Yeah, something you're not even thinking about at the moment, but something that can have really broad-ranging impacts. And just using a password manager is another one of those things where it seems very daunting at first, but once you actually use a password manager day-to-day, your life is so much easier. Like, I have to remember one password, and I can get into any account that I have with all of them being very, very well secured. That actual user experience is a huge improvement, but it does take some time to go ahead and rotate those passwords and all these accounts to save them. Like, it is a process, but it's another one of those things that's actually a benefit to everyday life. There's a lot more, and like I said, I'll share the blog post.
Yeah, and I'll definitely put it in the show notes. I'm keen. So we've got about 10 minutes or so left, Seth. Mm-hmm. I'm keen to spend some more time talking about self-censorship. And what that meant for me in recent years was, like, as someone who really started making content in conjunction with my Bitcoin rabbit hole experience. So I first bought Bitcoin 2015, sold some 2016, sold some more 2017. Suddenly 2020 rolls along and it basically just catches my attention and has become what will be, you know, a lifelong passion and 5 years of extreme work having gone in thus far. But I started making YouTube videos with a couple of mates, and then I started my own newsletter, and then I started my own podcast. It used to be one called Bitcoin with Jake, and then got involved in some startup businesses. It didn't quite work out. And at the start of this year, I said, okay, I want a podcast. I'm going to focus again on that and do it for myself. But what I noticed during that time, it's like a heavy Twitter user in particular, like, we now know the Twitter files are absolutely real, right? When Elon bought that company and that all became public information, governments had a very specific agenda and they had a relationship with a social media company that were doing things on their request. And that was pretty fucking scary. And in particular, as someone who spent time in Australia during the COVID period and experienced the kind of farcical lockdown rules that happened, in particular in Melbourne, where I lived at the time. Mm-hmm. And you said anything that wasn't in line with what the government wanted you to say, and you were shadow banned on Instagram. You know, my wife even ended up in a situation, believe it or not, where we went to a few protests being like, this is nuts. She mm-hmm. posts a picture online. We ended up with police officers at our doorstep. Because we think someone dobbed her in, one of like her 600 followers or something has like sent her to the police. Like crazy shit happened, right? Mm-hmm. But the digital world was clearly reacting to its customers, right? Who's paying the bills? The advertisers. All right. Well, who are the advertisers? Well, they're pharmaceutical companies. Hello. You know, the breadcrumbs are all there. Mm-hmm. And people started self-censoring a lot. Because you would see a post, but you know that that's not what they think because you spoke to them in person the day before. Yeah. And that's just a very simple example. I also wasn't able to share how I actually felt and thought. And so the idea of freedom of speech was clearly like affected, even if the rules of freedom of speech are still in place, i.e. the constitutional mm-hmm. rules that are apparently baked into law in a lot of these Western liberal democracies. Mm-hmm. But the reality wasn't the case. So to me, self-censorship became quite a serious problem, in particular digitally. And then as a content creator, it's then the platform risk. It's like you could spend years building a YouTube channel. And then actually they go, do you know what, guys? You've really not been very good. And we don't like you talking about X, Y, and Z. So your community guidelines rugged. One of the things that has come out of this that I'm very excited about is Noster. And so I'm keen to get your view on whether or not you're interested in that. And I'm trying to post as much content as I can there and interact as much as I can there. And I love that you can zap. And it's a place where you, in theory, cannot be switched off. And so when I post on Noster, I'm not self-censoring in the sense that I'm worried that someone's going to switch me off. But I'm also more careful with my word because I know it can't be deleted. So unlike a social media post on a traditional platform, it's like, oh, just delete mm-hmm. that. Now, the company still has that information, but your follower base can't see it. Yeah. So, yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? What do people actually think in an environment where they don't feel like they can say how they think? Pretty dangerous, in my view.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to dive into, like, what the specific approach that's best for everybody is. Like, It's interesting you say that because I've actually had a lot of good debates with people around Noster and around me continuing to primarily be on Twitter, on X now. But I think a lot of it comes down to like what is the purpose of your social media presence? And I think for most people, there's no reason for you to be on social media. There's no reason for you to be posting on social media. There are infinite studies that show how psychologically harmful social media is generally, how problematic it is to our relationships, to our real world functionality. There are immense problems there. So I think for most people, the answer is you shouldn't have to worry about self-censorship on social media because you just shouldn't even be there. You should be focused on the people.
That's really cool.
You actually
I wasn't
know.
Expecting you to say that.
Yeah, I know it's a little bit different than the angle you were taking, and no, I definitely and will touch on Noster.
No, it's true. Fair play. Like, why even bother? What are you doing there? Yeah.
There's some people, and I mean, like for many people, I think the benefit of social media is just from having like a highly selected group of people that they want to learn from, and they don't doom scroll. They go to those specific profiles, they learn from them, and they move on with their day. But that's a very hard thing to do because these companies are crafting social media to essentially prevent that. Like they want you to doom scroll, eyes on the platform for as long as possible is what they're building these things to. They know how human psychology and psyche works. They're building these tools to abuse you. But all that aside, most people, I think, just they don't need to be on social media, and you'll have far more impact and you'll have far less risk of censorship, far less problems with self-censorship if you're just talking to the actual community that you do life with. And you're doing it in a place where you're not being surveilled. So just switching from something like Facebook Messenger to Signal and using that for your group chats, for your family, for your friends, for your local Bitcoin meetup, whatever your actual real community is immensely beneficial. You're not going to have to worry about self-censorship. You don't have to worry about the police knocking at your door because of something you said. It's a much more freeing environment and one that is much better for most people. Now, that being said, there are some people who have a need to be on social media. Obviously, those are people with businesses that need to advertise. Those are people like you and I who are creating content, who want to educate and share the thoughts we have and the conversations we have with other people. And in that case, there are benefits. And I think we need to be very conscious of who are we trying to reach with our message. Like when I was hard into Noster, I loved the concept initially. I leaned into it pretty heavily, probably 12, 18 months ago. But when I actually sat back and thought about it, I realized that switching the majority of my content to Noster meant that I was not reaching the people that I cared about. Like the people on Noster, especially at that time, I think it's pretty much the same still, but especially at that time, were the hardcore Bitcoin people, the hardcore tech enthusiasts, or the people who already understood a lot of the messages I was trying to share. They already knew about the tools I was trying to talk about. They already knew about the need for personal privacy, self-sovereignty, because they knew about Noster. Like, let's be honest, Noster is like a niche within a niche.
Yeah.
So I realized like I could use Noster, and for my own personal benefit, there are some good reasons to do that. But I was missing the vast majority of the people that I wanted to reach. So I committed to, I don't have time to do both platforms. Like I'm very time restricted. So I decided I'm actually going to focus on Twitter. And I got a lot of shit for that. Because people understandably view Noster as a better platform for human freedom. And it is individually, but it also means that all the people who are on Twitter right now who have no idea what Noster is, who don't know how Bitcoin is a good tool for human freedom, who don't know anything about privacy tools, my voice missing, and I'm not trying to say that I'm like changing the world or anything, but my voice missing means that there are less people who are going to learn about these things if I was to switch all the way to Noster. And I thought that was a bad thing. Now that does mean that I am having to sacrifice some to do that because I really would not choose to be on Twitter. I hate social media as a general rule anyways, but I would personally prefer to be on Noster. But I thought that my platform would best benefit other people if I was on Twitter. And I think that's something that has to be a personal decision for each person. Really briefly on Noster, I think it's interesting. I think technologically, Noster's in many ways a very poor platform for social media. It's a good fallback in very extreme cases, but a lot of what makes Noster the protocol really useful actually makes it really bad for social media. And this is a side conversation maybe we can have another day because I don't want to eat up the remainder of
time.
That's cool,
Seth. I'm please continue. I'm very interested.
Yeah, I mean the two of the main things you actually mentioned as somewhat scary things are you cannot delete posts. technically you can request deletion. There is a new an Oster improvement proposal that came out 12 or 18 months ago where you can request deletion, but you're launching your data to a set of relays that you don't control. They can do what they want with it. And there is no native delete functionality. So you should expect that your data lives forever, which is, like you said, similar to social media, but instead of one central entity having that data, now probably multiple relay operators are still going to have that data, much less still be serving that data to your users. Another thing that's very problematic is the way that media works on Noster. Essentially, you're going to be revealing a lot about yourself to anyone who posts media. Because if I make a post and I host the media on my own server, it would be trivial for me to surveil where all these people coming from who are viewing this post and downloading this media. Now, some protections have been put in place in some Noster clients, but there's a lot of risk in how media is served on the Noster network. Because again, it's not served by a trusted entity, which again, there are pros and cons to Twitter having control over what media is posted on their platform and what people can see. But it also means that I'm only trusting Twitter themselves with info about my network connection, my IP address, that sort of thing, when I view this media. Whereas in Noster, I'm connecting to who knows what as the source for that. The third thing I'll mention as well is network privacy generally in Noster is very poor. So when you think about how Noster actually works, generally you're connecting to a set of relays, 5, 10 relays within the Noster network. You're connecting to them directly. You're revealing to them who you are on Noster. Now, obviously, that could be a NIM or something, but you're revealing to them your public key on Noster. You're revealing to them information about everyone you follow, and you're revealing everything about your network to them as well. You're revealing your IP address directly to those relays. Now, that some of that can be solved by using a VPN or using Tor, but that is another one of the downsides, is you're revealing a lot about yourself to a lot of relays where you maybe don't trust the operators themselves in the same way you might trust a Twitter or something like that.
I think what's caught my attention about Noster the most is the yes, it's potentially an edge case. Rogan mid-COVID with the biggest platform in the world on Spotify was having Peter McCullough come on and talk about, like, is this really a good idea, guys? So even in that highly contentious moment, the biggest guy on the a centralized platform still didn't get deleted. But there are definitely cases of people being canceled by social media companies.
For sure.
So at some point, you probably will come in the crosshairs. And in the same way that it seems obvious to me that Bitcoin is a better foundation for building business based on being able to measure value correctly forever, I feel like Noster might be similar in terms of like the cornerstone of a media business or any type of personal communication online, because of the fact that you can't be deleted. And what I'm always looking for is to learn from people. So you've already taught me some stuff. It's like, oh, here's some things you should probably think about, Jake, that actually might mean you're not so bullish on Noster. And that's already maybe a more sophisticated kind of user of it in a sense. And I wouldn't understand the information that my network shows to Noster, if that makes sense. So that's just not an area I understand about. But to give you an example, I've been working just briefly with Fishcake, who's a developer building Noster.build, which is the server I've been using and paying my sats to host media.
Yeah.
And what I would love is a better analytics feature on their platform where it's like, I want to be able to aggregate the data. It's like, how many views have I got? When did I get them? Calculate it over a 12-month period. And at this point, Noster.build is not even sophisticated enough to do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you were using a YouTube, you could get demographics, location, all this like data. And what Fishcake pointed out is you just don't have that much data about a Noster user in the same way that you'd have YouTube analytics. So, but maybe, and that was my previous view, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. Like, especially in the media hosting side of things, you can learn an immense amount of information about an individual user because you know the public key of that user. So you know anything that's public on their profile, their Noster profile. Mm. You know the IP address of that user. So generally you'll know, again, depending on if they're using VPN or Tor, but most people are not, you're going to know roughly what city they live in, what country they live in, obviously. You could probably tell a lot from their Noster profile, things about demographic. You're going to know what language they speak. You're going to know what time of day they're generally online. If you're seeing this user with this IP address is grabbing media from nostr.build only between the hours of 8 and 5 Eastern, you know, they're probably on the East Coast, even if they're using a VPN or Tor. There is a lot of data you can collect, again, because it's a central server where someone has to reach out from their machine and download something. So you could learn a lot. Now, I think the good thing within the nostr paradigm is there's not this ad monopoly. So there's not a lot of financial incentive to build out that sort of surveillance. That doesn't mean that it can't exist or that it doesn't exist right now, but that there's not as much financial incentive. And that is one of the very powerful things about nostr, is that because there's not an ad monopoly, a lot of the brokenness that exists on Twitter and other social media platforms has no financial incentive to exist, which is a real upside of nostr.
Yeah. But then to also temper that, you take any half decent podcast that is selling adverts as sponsorship contracts, and you look at the revenue stats of that podcast, the vast majority of the revenue of the podcast will be from probably a fiat denominated sponsorship contract, not zaps. You know, people are sending not even like a fraction of a penny, right? It's not yet there, but it is a very, very cool concept. Awesome. Well, Seth, listen, I've really loved learning from you. An hour has flown by. Thank you so much for your time. If people want to reach out and get in touch, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, best way is generally, like I mentioned, if you want to follow on social media, that's where I post many of my public thoughts, at least, just at Seth for Privacy on X. Cool. If you want to read more about just the deeper thoughts that I have, sethforprivacy.com is my blog. I do have my own podcast, which I very intermittently create and post to, which is called Opt Out, just optoutpod.com. And then lastly, a lot of my time right now goes to building financial freedom tools at Cake Wallet. We're a Bitcoin and multi-crypto wallet that builds the cutting edge privacy tech, especially on Bitcoin. And we're really pushing the boundaries of what's possible there. So a lot of my time goes there, and that's cakewallet.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time, Seth.
Thanks, Jake.